So am I still waiting? Waiting a long time.
Waiting for tonight.
Listen to review,
right now, right? That's what you say. We get it by now.
1, 2, 1, 2. Check 1, 2. Check 1, 2. Still a bit of his, but... Whatever, fuck it.
Compulsive behavior. Addiction. An obsession. With one roll of the dice, they can be on top of the world. Adrenaline surges through their veins. A euphoric rush. Everything is on the line. Every time they take a chance, they gamble with nerves of steel and a cold heart. Unsure of the outcome, they must go for broke. They must let it ride. Exposing themselves to hazards, to risks. The aftermath is unpredictable. In this game, you only get one opportunity. Their fortunes will be made and possibly lost with one roll of the dice. Tonight, those dice are fully loaded. Tonight, these men will risk it all.
Welcome to Review Away. Are you recording?
Yep.
I'm John Pollock, and I'm joined by Wei Tin.
Yeah.
The MVP of this site.
Yeah, you're fucking right, I am.
You've had a long week.
Yeah, no, it's fine.
No, it's not, Wei.
How are you doing? My week's not as bad as Jason Agnew's, I'll tell you that.
Well, yeah,
Jesus Christ.
You have both uses of eyes, so that's a positive. Though
Eyes, what do you mean?
Eyes. I'm saying you have both use. Your eyes are in use.
Oh, okay, gotcha. Yeah, yeah.
He had one shut, which is now reopened. If you're following his Instagram, Agnew Jason on Instagram, for all the latest on his softball incidents.
He had a Triple H Chris Jericho moment.
Yes, very much so.
Man.
He was out colder than... Chris Jericho at the end of the Last Man Standing match.
I mean, bloodier than Triple H.
You're right. Probably more color.
Yep.
From what I understand. Mm-hmm. A detailed review of his softball incident where another man was knocked out cold.
Really?
Yeah. You should listen to your own show.
I mean, I listened. I didn't hear about...
He ran into our friend Kevin, and Kevin was out.
I thought Kevin just had a hematoma.
He told me he was out cold momentarily.
Jesus, wow.
So there was...
Probably, he was concussed then.
Yeah, this is hardcore softball.
Softball is like...
I'm a little concerned. I'm subbing. I'm playing on their team on Saturday.
I've seen more injuries come out of softball than I have from hockey, from, you know, soccer, maybe even from... I guess I never really see people play football.
My worst injury, I once dove into home... And someone hadn't nailed down the home plate.
Yeah.
So I slid with my arm going right against the nail that was up from the ground. That was painful. But the worst was just playing second. And this is just during practice. And the ball just jumped. It hit like this bit of the dirt in front of me. And it just shot up. And it nailed me in the throat. Brutal.
Yikes.
There's nothing worse than getting hit full impact in the throat, Wei.
Oh, man.
So, injuries happen. Yeah. Softball sucks.
Yeah. You should get into MMA. You're probably safer.
How exhausted are you, Wei? Because I think people just look at, man, this guy, he's been going all out on the website. Multiple shows this week. I think you've done more shows than me. And yet no one knows the insane move that you have had all week long.
It's not that bad. It's just like, it sucks like not really having your comfort items around. And I moved back home. I moved back with my parents for, and I'm just doing it temporarily while I look for another place. And so their house is just so fucking messy. Like, my parents are hoarders.
I've been
to the T. You know,
like, your bathroom is something to behold.
It's fucked up, man. I used to think it was just like an Asian thing. Oh man, like my Asian parents, they don't really know how to take proper care of this house. It's just my parents. I've been to plenty of other Asians' homes and they're fine, but like, man, my parents just keep a ton of bullshit around. And I mean, their justification is that, you know, they grew up poor and so, oh, we might never get this thing again.
They're thankful for everything.
Yeah, so they're so unwilling to let things go and throw things out. But man, now it's just like my mom like keeps these fucking half-used batteries. Keeps all of them, like keeps half-used batteries in the event we need some batteries.
Listen, she was here in Toronto during the blackout in 2003. Changed your whole perspective.
Man, but then it's just like bullshit like that piled on top of more bullshit like that. So even like the good stuff, like she would buy like new toothbrushes. She'd always buy like new toothbrushes. A ton of toothpaste, and like
she buys these in bulk.
No, so she'll buy like two or three each time she goes to Shoppers Drug Mart, but she'll like toss all this stuff in the corner along with like the garbage, so that like when we need the good stuff, the new stuff, we can't find it because it's all buried underneath, mixed with all the garbage. So I'm like digging through all this stuff and I'm finding like, you know, like brand new bottles of Jergens hand lotion mixed with like. Empty envelopes, like from mail, you know what I mean? Like just it's a fucking mess. And so I haven't like been able to even have, I haven't even had the space to unpack my own things. I haven't had the space to build my bed. It's just like I've been getting bad sleep every single night. So I'm just, and plus the commute.
The commute's tough, yeah, when you were so close and now you're so far.
But again, not a worse week than Jason Agnew, I'll say.
One of my grandmothers actually used to, she went nuts on those home shopping networks, mm-hmm. where she would see something she likes and then she'd order 10 of everything. So when we would go over, her basement was just the home shopping network down there.
Man.
And we would go down there. It's like, this is a warehouse. Like, what do you need 10 of these for? And it was just multiple things. Every stupid contraption that you ever saw on the home shopping network, she not only bought, she multiplied and bought 10 of them.
It has to be the only reason why the infomercials and those things still are able to still exist is because they prey on old, stupid people.
Oh, what an insult. Thank you.
Well, I mean, my dad has bought plenty of home shop, like, infomercial bullshit, too. So
best story ever from this grandmother who is no longer with us. Her doctor at one point was telling her, you have to limit your coffee to one cup a day. So we go over to her house. She's got like what I would describe as a popcorn bowl full of coffee. I said, Grandma, why do you have a popcorn bowl full of coffee? And she explains, well, they told me one cup, but they never told me what size of cup. I'm like, Grandma, the joke is not on them. The joke is on you. You're not to be drinking all this coffee. That's the point here. They're trying to help you. You're not outsmarting them. But I thought that was just the greatest thing. I was like, wow, this woman's a genius.
Yeah, I know.
Or not. I don't know. But nonetheless, well, hilarious story.
I hope it wasn't coffee related, whatever her.
No. Was. She was elderly. Passed due to natural causes.
Gotcha.
And what a segue now over. Actually, before we start Fully Loaded, I know you're one to, you'll hear some news items and then you tend to research. So I don't know if you had the time, but is there any update on this Drake Eminem rumor that I was intently listening to? Is there a possibility?
Actually, I read something came up on my Facebook news. You know, the side panel on the right side or the trending area.
Okay.
I just read something there. That's pretty much where I get my news.
Okay, well,
that's where I get my pop culture is, in that little blurb on the right side of the Facebook thing. But I heard that the DJ, Ebro, he was only joking about it. He had made it all up. He cried wolf.
Oh, are you kidding me?
Yeah.
Got everyone's hopes up?
Yeah. I mean, maybe it'll happen now. Who knows?
Wow. Well, maybe this will create an artificial demand now for this diss track.
Yeah, of course.
Is Eminem done with diss tracks at this point? Is he above that?
I mean,
I don't think he is.
you know, I'm sure maybe
there's no way to just jump back into things than by dropping
a bit. But I mean, you know, of all people, that fighter never fully retires. You know what I mean? A fighter always has the itch. And Eminem was a great fighter. Probably still is.
He's kind of the George St. Pierre of rap at this point. Is he staying? Is he going? He's a legend.
Mm-hmm.
He could come back instantly and he could challenge for that crown.
If there's a big money fight, maybe that's what it takes. And a Drake bout would be a big money fight.
All right. Well, Fully Loaded. You know, we space these out way because our schedules were just getting to be way too much. This weekly, we've had to create bi-weekly shows out of Review Away and Bauer and Pollock. So thus, instead of reviewing a show every week, now we have 2 weeks to prepare. And yet both of us left this till the last minute. We really took these 2 weeks for granted. 12 of the 14 days between shows were, there was no focus on Fully Loaded. And then suddenly, we got loaded quickly, having to catch up on this pay-per-view event from July of 2000. You finished this 20 minutes ago.
Yeah, welcome to my life. I mean, I'm just somebody who leaves everything till the last minute. So
I was worried about watching it too early, and I would forget certain details. I like to watch it close to the proximity of when we'll be talking about it. I don't want to review something 2 weeks after I've watched it.
Yeah, me neither. But I will say it is quite nice, especially last week, not having to watch anything in advance, so
Could you have imagined your moving weekend and the last thing on your mind, fucking Pollock is making me watch Fully Fucking Loaded.
As long as we have enough, you know, as long as we can talk about the shows, I think it's okay. You know, like, we're not in a huge rush.
No. This is a very calm, relaxed environment.
Yeah.
It's Friday.
Oh, yeah, Fridays. Yeah, we've never done shows on Fridays.
Yeah, well, we are now. Had you ever seen this event?
I don't think so, actually. No. I was watching wrestling at the time, but I don't think I saw this pay-per-view.
I didn't remember until watching this show that the night after this pay-per-view was the first time I ever went to O'Grady's Tap and Grill.
Wow.
Yes, the first time. My buddy said, hey, I want to go to this O'Grady's thing. I said, well, I'll come along for sure. I had heard about this.
You actually had friends who listened to The Law. Like,
yes.
Even in high school.
I did. Well, my one friend that I've mentioned other times, my buddy Mike, only guy that watched wrestling to the level that I did.
So he must have been a bigger fan than you if he wanted to go to O'Grady's.
Well, I think it was, he suggested it because I think his dad was actually going to drive us there. I didn't even know where this place was. I knew it was College in McCall, but that meant nothing to me at 16 and like going downtown to watch wrestling. So we went the night after, and then he quickly dropped off. I think he came like two or three times and then I never came back. Here I am 16 years later, Way. I'm still in part.
You stuck around in a big, big way.
Yeah. This was during my Chris Benoit, Lance Storm newsletter writing era.
I don't think you talk about that enough. I don't know if enough people are aware that John Pollock used, a very young, how old are you at this time?
16.
16-year-old John Pollock used to write the newsletters for Lance Storm and Chris Benoit. Why don't you promote that more often?
Half of which don't really go on a resume very well in 2016. But yes, this was, I guess it was Jeff Merrick I dealt with and just asked, hey, I would love to do anything related to your site. I am a listener.
See, that's the type of hustle. That's the type of initiative that I think every 16-year-old aspiring pro wrestling MMA journalist should show.
Wow. And then he said, well, we email out weekly newsletters for Lance Storm and Chris Benoit. Do you want to oversee them? I said, do I?
And what would this job entail?
A lot of it, man, it's going back so far. It was broken up into sections. So you would have a quick recap of whatever they did on TV that week. So with Benoit, it was on Raw. Lance, it was on Nitro and Thunder.
So you actually had things to talk about. It wasn't like, they weren't periods where like, oh, maybe like Benoit wasn't doing anything or Lance was not even on Nitro.
No, they were always centric about like, what they were doing. It wasn't like there was nothing going on with them.
Yeah.
And I can't remember how long it lasted. It wasn't like this went on for these newsletters lasted I would say a year tops.
And so how much interaction would you actually have with either of them?
Oh, very little. Very little. Lance, I remember, I think a few emails back and forth at times. Sometimes there would be people that would contact me that were other wrestlers or something thinking I was Lance and having to get them in. For one, like an old volleyball coach of Lance once contacted me, and then I forwarded it to Lance. And so Lance said, always let me know when people contact you or something, because I think people just assumed that I was somehow attached to Lance Storm or something, or his assistant.
I assume Lance was pretty busy at the time, but
These guys were all on the road.
Yeah, but Lance is like a pretty prolific, you know, online, has a pretty prolific online presence.
Yes, you know, so. And this was in 2000 when he was, to me, at the forefront of websites, and that was when the law was overseeing his site, and they had those really what predated podcasts were just those weekly audio updates that Merrick would do with Lance, with Benoit. Dynamite Kid was involved. Mm-hmm. Perry Saturn was there. Mm-hmm. And I was amazed at the time. Here are WWE guys, WWF at the time, and they're doing like weekly interviews with Merrick, and they were always pretty open, and Lance as well. There wasn't really that restrictive nature in WCW, but
it probably took you like half an hour to download the file.
Yeah, listening on Real Player.
Yeah.
Yes. Oh, those were the days, Way, of the year 2000.
There's kids, like, there are people listening that are, like, 15 right now.
A newsletter?
Real Player?
Real Player.
It's not lit.
So, back to Fully Loaded. This was a show. 16,504 people going to Reunion Arena in Dallas. And I believe we've reviewed the Raw from earlier this year. It was February of 2000. They were at Reunion Arena, and there was a 10-man tag, and it was right when the Radicals had first come in. And it was an unbelievable crowd reaction for this 10-man tag. I think it's fondly remembered to this day.
I actually don't recall it at all.
Well, we've reviewed it. I'm 95% sure, and you can go check the archives, lawradio.proboards.com. So when they announced they were doing a pay-per-view at Reunion Arena, I had that Raw fresh in my brain that this crowd is going to be awesome for this show. Mm-hmm. And I don't think it ever reached the level of that 10-man tag, but nonetheless, a pretty solid crowd here. Yeah. 16,500, 420,000 buys on pay-per-view, which sounds very impressive. This was actually the second lowest pay-per-view number of the year for the company. So that tells you the kind of business they were doing on pay-per-view at the time. And in many ways, this was a pay-per-view that was the culmination of a lot of new talent coming in and a different level of work rate and focusing on three main eventers against three guys that are the next wave in Benoit, Jericho, and Angle. And that's what this pay-per-view is built around, the established guys against the young guys. WWF doing a better job of the Millionaires Club than against New Blood than WCW did at all during this time.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And certainly, I feel like, in you know, with the addition of the Radicals, I felt like the match quality, the in-ring quality of the actual roster seemed to have taken a big leap.
Oh, yeah. Post-Radicals, the in-ring just leaps and bounds to me ahead of 1999, if you look a year ago at that roster. So the theme of this pay-per-view, it's called Fully Loaded, which the first year they did this pay-per-view was 98, and the poster features Triple H doing a crotch chop with the turnbuckle or something coming out to represent his dick, I guess.
Fully Loaded. Let's Google this.
I'll pull up the
did
post.
Did we do that, Matt, show?
I don't. Maybe. Wait, it's all a blur. But here, I don't want you to think I'm crazy here. So this was the poster, okay? And it was,
dude, we've done this, and that's not a turnbuckle.
Well, what is it? It's supposed to be something. Like, there's a okay.
Can you zoom in on the photo?
Let's get it better. Photo?
Yeah, if you want to follow along, just Google image search Fully Loaded 1998, and I'm pretty positive we've had this exact same debate where you think that's a turnbuckle on his crotch. It's just, I believe it's just his trunks.
Oh, you're right. Yeah, it's his trunks.
Oh, God, I can't believe
come on, look at that. That looks like a 3D object, though, coming out.
It's a WWF logo on
his dick.
On the stripe of his trunks.
What is he chopping?
His crotch.
Exactly. Yeah, okay.
So?
Don't make me sound crazy.
It does not look like a turnbuckle, man.
Okay. Well, I think you could debate it, but I will concede that it is his tights.
Yeah, I'm almost positive we've had this exact same debate at some point.
Getting back to this theme, this had no phallic implications. This year's Fully Loaded. Instead...
Nor did that one. That was just Triple H doing a crotch chop. That's just his move.
Okay.
Fully Loaded did... I think it... What did you think it meant?
In 1998...
Like, loaded of what? Semen?
I'm pretty sure Val Venus does an exact promo on that very pay-per-view and uses Fully Loaded to describe something. And it's not his tights or his material that he's wearing.
I just don't think that the WWE, even in the peak of the Attitude Era, would have named a pay-per-view after, like, you know, like a large sack of... testicles.
Yeah. Vince Russo would never come up with an idea like that when he came up with the idea of naming an entire national promotion after tits and ass. They would never think of naming something that
Was that the reason?
Like, that was totally the inspiration for TNA.
Okay.
It was always to be a play on tits and ass. Clever. Very clever. So this year's, my point here, we had a gambling theme for a pay-per-view in Dallas. This felt very much like this is a pay-per-view reserved for a Las Vegas locale. Instead, it was Dallas. And I don't know how we get from Fully Loaded to the gambling motif of this pay-per-view, other than maybe loaded. The dice are loaded.
Yeah, that's exactly, I think, what it meant.
Well. It's quite the interpretation of the Fully Loaded concept.
Okay. I don't...
I could go another half hour.
No, this conversation's just... I'm sick of it. I'm done with it. Let's move on.
The first words in this video package were compulsive behavior, addiction, and obsession.
Yeah, this was a definite David Sahadi joint.
Oh, yeah. This was getting into the dark, dark catacombs of the human psyche as we head into this pay-per-view. Mentioning a euphoric rush and comparing it to gambling, going for broke by taking the ultimate risk, and then a roulette wheel is shown, and fortunes are made and lost with one roll of the dice, and tonight, those dice are fully loaded, meaning that these matches are fixed, right? If the dice are loaded?
Oh, okay, that's what that means.
Loaded dice.
I don't gamble, man. I don't even know.
And then a craps table is shown in the graphic, which... dare I say, was the only crap we might have seen on this show. The announcers are Jim Ross and Jerry Lawler, and they plug the three main events for tonight with Angle and The Undertaker, Chris Jericho and Triple H, and then The Rock against Chris Benoit. Started off with a mixed tag match. Actually, intergender, correct? Because we could have male-on-female violence, and boy, did we get it in this match. Test and Albert, TNA, a playoff of tits and ass, teaming with Trish Stratus against the Hardys and Lita. This was not only Trish Stratus's first pay-per-view match, this was one of her first matches, period, on television. She had only started wrestling on TV, I believe, the month prior. So she was exceptionally green at this point in 2000. They showed a video package where the entire focus of this feud is Trish and Lita, where Trish's shirt was torn off in the build-up to this. Lita was put through a table, and we had an Indian strap involved in this, where these women had a desire to whip one another constantly.
Yeah, it was pretty much the feud. I mean, hot girls attacking each other.
With belts.
Yeah.
With leather. Out came the Hardys, including, I guess, fixed and working Matt Hardy. Trish came out with Test and Albert, and then the match begins. Matt gets sent to the floor by Albert, and Lawler is just in love with Trish's outfit. He's yelling, "Baby got back," and wants the cameraman to go show Trish from behind. This mic's driving me nuts. There was a leg drop off the second rope by Matt, then tags in Jeff. Crowd was super hot for the Hardys here. Then the crowd starts chanting for puppies, this while Jeff and Test were inside of the ring. Trish then got tagged in, slaps Matt around, and then misses, and she slaps Test. And then Trish runs away as Lita's tagged in. Lots of boos for this as they want to see the women get involved. Test missed an elbow drop. Matt comes in. Jeff breaks up the pinfall with a swanton. Lita hit a tornado DDT to Test. A lot of offense she got here on the guys, including a Hurricane Rana that she hit after a crossbody to Albert on the floor. Albert then knocks Lita down from the floor. Trish's tag goes for the cover after Test hits a powerbomb, but Lita kicks out. And then there's a bulldog kick out by Lita. Lita stops Trish on the top, hits a superplex. The guys are fighting on the floor, and then Lita climbs to the top and hits a moonsault right out of the playbook of the great Muda and pins Trish in 13 minutes and 12 seconds.
I thought it was a surprisingly really good match, and it was largely built around Lita and Trish, whom the crowd seemed to be very attached to, and I thought they, you know, kept Lita Trish separate for, and they built up to their interaction finally very well. I didn't really love Lita kicking out of Tess' finisher. Tess hit her his pump handle slam finisher on Lita, and Lita just kicked out at two. And you know, I don't mind if Chyna kicked out of it because she's an active wrestler, but you had here a female wrestler who doesn't wrestle usually with the men, and I just feel like it kind of it killed Tess' finish, unfortunately. But I thought the match itself was actually really good.
Albert afterwards clotheslined Lita from behind, then delivered a splash to Matt and a big boot, and then they did the exact same to Jeff. Crowd is chanting assholes at Test and Albert, and then Trish grabs the Indian strap and starts whipping Lita, and this would build up to an Indian strap match 24 hours later on Raw between the women.
Certainly, you know, this was not the Trish Stratus that we would later come to meet in terms of in-ring ability, but I thought it's still a very successful match with the inclusion of her and Lita adding a lot to it.
Yeah, and I think by this point, when Trish was first paired with Test and Albert, you were wondering, is this going to finally help get Test and Albert over at this point? Test had come off that Stephanie storyline where he was really not positioned well and all of that. By this point in the summer, you really saw this act as this was a springboard for Trish, and these were just the guys she was paired with. I don't think they really had much plans for Test or Albert at this point. Backstage, Mick Foley, who was the commissioner at this time. Look at that. Mick Foley as the authority figure in 2000.
Something's never changed.
How far we have come. He's talking to a guy about what a bed of nails felt like when Edge runs up and says that Christian might have food poisoning. Mick Foley believes that Christian might have Frady Cat-itis. Burn. Edge says to go get a doctor so they can prove it, even though they have a tag title defense later on tonight. So the tag title match is now in question. The Undertaker appears at the arena on his bike, spots Kurt Angle, and chases after him backstage on his motorcycle. As Kurt runs away, he stumbles into an empty room. The Undertaker then goes into the room with the motorcycle. Angle hops over this bar counter and then runs out of the room scared. This was a perfect description of what was to come later on tonight.
Yeah.
Angle running in fear from this man on his bike.
It's a ridiculous image to see the Undertaker ride his motorcycle around the backstage of an arena, and to see Kurt Angle run away from him like it was like a Roadrunner cartoon. And so it was kind of silly, too, how it ended, because Kurt basically led Taker into a room, and all Kurt had to do was just walk back out, because Taker didn't have enough space to back out and make a three-point turn.
If he had just blocked the exit, getting off his bike, there would have been a collision of these two individuals.
Yeah, I thought it actually made this Taker look kind of dumb. How long had it been since he had returned?
Only 2 months at this point. Right, yeah, he had only come back in May.
As the new gimmick.
Yes. And boy, did this bring me back to my hatred of Biker Taker. Did not enjoy this guy. Taz and Al Snow were next. A battle of future TNA color commentators. Al Snow charges the ring. The match begins. There's a super kick that lands for Al, and then a dominator into a sit-out by Snow for a two count. Snow hits a leg drop from the top, and Lawler just calls him stupid for going back up to the top, where Snow then hits a top rope moonsault for a two count, and then it's Lawler who points out the fact that we had just seen a top rope moonsault in the last match with Lita. There was a boring chant here. Al Snow grabs head, and his left knee gets clipped. There were double underhooks applied by Taz and headbutts to the chest. Sorry, Al Snow did that. And then Taz came back with a T-bone suplex. Taz mission gets blocked, but then a waist lock is countered, and Taz applies the Taz mission and taps out Al Snow in 5 minutes and 20 seconds.
You know, I thought Snow was really trying to wrestle like he was somebody who was really pissed off, because I guess in the lead up to this, Taz had always gotten the better of him or something. And, you know, Snow ended up taking most of the offense in this match, but the crowd simply wasn't with him for much of it. In fact, I thought most his largest ovation came from him lifting up head. And the crowd just really wasn't with them for this match. I thought he was kind of working almost a little fast and a little too rushed to kind of latch on to any type of notable story that I could find. And overall, just the match just kind of seemed there.
Yeah, on this card, it was not one that really stood out. Christian is in a stall pretending to vomit as Edge brings Foley and a doctor in. The doctor checks on Christian, doesn't know if he can compete tonight. And Mick Foley reluctantly apologizes for doubting them that Christian was in fact ill. Triple H and Stephanie McMahon are in their office, and there's all these flowers all over the office that are being delivered, and Hunter is very jealous. He wants to know who's sending these, and this upsets Stephanie because she had assumed that Hunter was sending all these flowers to him. But instead, Hunter gets up, finds a card, and reveals that the message says, wishing Stephanie and your man good luck. It's true, without being signed by Kurt Angle. And Hunter gets very upset, thinking that Kurt is playing the home wrecker here. So Kurt had multiple enemies on this show.
Yeah.
Adding Hunter to the list.
Mm-hmm.
So then in some strange timing, we cut away from Hunter and Stephanie and their storyline romance to China entering the arena. Eddie Guerrero comes out. He is with China, taking on Perry Saturn, who was paired with Terry at this point, as the guy from El Paso, Texas, took on the guy from Boston for the European title.
I mean, pretty much the case with most European title matches.
Yes.
Wasn't it?
This European championship, I think, had largely run its course.
Yeah.
You could have said years before this, at this point, in 2000.
Who would you say was the most prolific European champion? If you could make a best of European champions DVD, who would be on the cover?
When I hear about the European title, the images that come to mind were that awesome final with British Bulldog and Owen Hart to create the title. You think D'Lo Brown and the chest protector.
Yep.
He's probably the guy most associated. And the one night only match with British Bulldog and Shawn Michaels. And outside of that, I don't know what you would fill that DVD with.
Yeah.
Eddie Guerrero and Perry Saturn, a revival of the feud involving the Filthy Animals and the Revolution from WCW a year prior. China shoves Eddie away and then strikes down Perry with a forearm and goes after Terry. And Guerrero and Saturn then fight in the aisle. Then they go into the ring for the start of the match as Terry has disappeared, presumably backstage. And Eddie, working in a T-shirt here. There was a top rope Rana by Guerrero after China clotheslined, Saturn on the floor? And Saturn then gets thrown into the steps as Guerrero then hits a crossbody to Saturn on the floor. Guerrero hit a Hurricane Rana coming off the top. And then Guerrero's on his shoulders, gets turned into a powerbomb by Saturn. And somehow in all of this, Perry's head got cut open. The crowd was really not into this. There was a pop-up powerbomb by Perry. Then Saturn missed a moonsault off the top. Sorry, this is when Lawler pointed it out. 3 matches in a row with top rope moonsaults. And this one being the first one that missed.
3 tornado DDTs in the first 3 matches, too.
Yes, yes. Saturn then climbs up the corner, gets drop kicked to the floor, and then China approaches him, and Saturn just punches her in the face, knocking her onto the table. A very different time, 16 years ago.
Oh, she was an active wrestler in the men's division, so you can accept it.
You can cheap shot a woman if she's would, on the roster.
It's not a cheap shot at that point, I don't think. She's in matches. She's a former IC champion.
Terry returns, and Saturn uses Terry as a shield from Eddie, and Terry then kicks Eddie low, and he gets sent into the post, and then back into the ring. Saturn hits a top rope elbow drop and pins Eddie at 8 minutes and 11 seconds to win the European title.
Yeah, I must have been missing something here, because I thought the dynamic seemed all off with the baby faces in Eddie and China starting off the match with the 2-on-1 advantage, and it was China that was attacking Perry Saturn on the outside while Eddie was distracting. I'm assuming like that was maybe her getting revenge for something that they had done prior to this pay-per-view. Otherwise, I didn't really understand, because it seemed like the babyfaces had such a large advantage over the heel. And then it took, you know, your 100-pound little Terry to come out to even the odds and help Perry Saturn win. Maybe it was just this match that didn't really work as a standalone outside of the TV.
What a weird combination of Perry Saturn and Terry together.
Perry and Terry.
They rhyme. That's true. I'm really testing my memory here, but I seem to recall this match was added maybe on the SmackDown before Fully Loaded, so you didn't even have a super long build-up before the announcement of this match. But I remember when it was announced that these guys are going to get a singles match on a pay-per-view, and I had high expectations for it, and this match was kind of just...
It was disappointing.
Yeah, for what you would expect from these two and at this period of time, a little underwhelming. Edge and Christian are bragging about how they fooled Mick Foley when Foley walks in and sees that Christian is perfectly fine. And then Christian pretends to get sick again. He runs over to the stall, and Mick Foley peeps over top and sees him pouring something from this bucket into the toilet. It is fake vomit. And Mick Foley tells him that you are totally busted. And the tag title match with the APA is on for tonight.
We had a point of view cutaway of Mick Foley peeking from over the stall here.
Oh, yeah. We had this was a multi-take shoot.
Yeah. So, I mean, you know, something a little different than their typical.
The Foley cam. Maybe we'll see that come back on Raw. Michael Cole is with The Undertaker. And he asks The Undertaker what his medical opinion is of his knee, which was attacked on SmackDown by Kurt Angle. And Undertaker spits and then gives his sarcastic medical opinion that he's going to need his foot to be removed from Angle's ass. Then, off into the distance, he sees Kurt getting onto his bike. And Taker runs off to find him, referring to him as a little bitch, and chases after Kurt Angle.
Taker just like looked. I thought he looked really stupid in all this. He looked like Mr. Wilson, and Kurt Angle is Dennis the Menace.
What a comparison! Yeah. Yes, and Dennis the Menace would have to be one of your main players for years to come. So this was a
Mr. Wilson was. You know, supposed to main
Mr. Wilson is your big icon. Yeah. Edge and Christian took on the APA next for the WWE tag titles. And Edge and Christian came out and cut quite the promo on Dallas. They run down their sports team saying how the Dallas Stars were not repeat champions after winning the Stanley Cup in 99 and then failing to repeat. Yet the Dallas Cowboys are repeat offenders. And then Christian brings up the JFK assassination. There was no way this was ending with anything but something probably awful. And he said that had JFK spent 5 more minutes in the city of Dallas, he would have committed suicide anyway. It's like, wow. There was a point later in the match where Jim Ross actually came on and apologized for these comments. So I wouldn't doubt that these comments were...
Scripted
ahead of time.
Yeah.
They had certainly much more leeway in 2000, but even this for me was something that, wow.
Sure. Yeah, I don't think it's something they'd ever say now. At the time, though, it wasn't like he just died. I mean, come on, it was like, what, 20, 30 years?
Well, 63, so.
Yeah, more than that.
So
that's fine.
It's been 27 years.
Yeah.
The APA come out, and this is
37.
63?
Yeah. From 2000?
37 years. Much better math than
makes
me.
Makes it totally okay.
Yeah, definitely. Once it's after 30 years, that's
yep.
a lengthy period of time. The APA comes out, and Bradshaw gets the microphone. And this is maybe one of the first times he got a really lengthy time to cut a promo. It was typically quick stuff backstage, very quick, 30 seconds.
They made him an acolyte, which I don't even know what that is. But I don't think the guy spoke at all as an acolyte.
Well, now he was a talker.
Like how do you take the Southern dude and you turn him into a Satanist? Was that what he was playing?
Yes. Do you want to know the definition? Why?
Yes, please.
Do you want to learn something?
I've always wanted to know what an acolyte was.
An acolyte. A person assisting the celebrant in a religious service or procession.
Okay. Yeah, I just don't see JBL, the future JBL, and think, he's a servant to a future procession.
Yes, with symbols and paint on his chest. Awful. But now they were shifting more to the APA characters. So JBL comes out and calls it cheap heat and goes on to praise Dallas, which... kind of contradicting himself when it comes to cheap heat. This would be the exact opposite of that, playing to Dallas, and mentions them having 5 Super Bowl championships and have won every major sporting championship there is.
Like as if that was the only source of pride that we could associate with this state.
He says he mocks Canada for their beer and their hair. Shit. And then mentions...
He was for the two of them.
Yeah. I guess. Yeah. Sebastian Bach would be very upset about this promo. And then goes on to drop the names Dick Murdoch, the Fabulous Freebirds, Bruiser Brody, and the Von Erichs, who ruled this building. And Lawler, just under his breath, says, geez, wasn't that like 100 years ago? Which was not. It was closer to...
37.
No, half of that, more than half of that. Lawler reacts, and then JBL says that Edge and Christian are going to be their personal bitches as they go fight on the floor. But very hot crowd as a result of this promo. I mean, this was, JBL would get more time, especially there was WrestleMania the following year in Houston where right before the match, Bradshaw got to cut a big promo for Texas, and you could see this guy had a lot of fire in his promos.
A very, very good, very spirited promo from JBL here. And, you know, to think that clearly the guy was always talented, especially in that department. But, I mean, this guy almost never made it out of the mid-card, low mid-card and tag team division, if not for a drastic makeover. So perhaps there are people right now, John, on the current WWE low to mid-card that, you know, will someday have a drastic makeover that'll turn them into future world champions too.
Yeah, and looking back at Bradshaw, he's someone, and you know, I never saw this guy as elite main event level, but he never gets that position he did on SmackDown without the brand split. There's no way. They were just so short on heels on that show that if it was a just joint roster at that point, there's no way he's getting that top position as he did. So that was someone that did come out of the brand split and 100% benefited. That was the big run of his career. Anyway, match begins. There's a missile drop kick from Christian as Edge is the legal man. Edge and Christian double-team Bradshaw. They came back with a shoulder block off the top to Edge. And then Farouk is in. They fought on the floor. Edge knocks Bradshaw into the timekeeper's table and then grabs one of the tag titles and uses it on Farouk in the match for the DQ at 5 minutes and 32 seconds. And then they attack Edge and Christian in the aisle on the way to the back. This totally felt way like one of those, we don't want to beat the acolytes, and how do we get out of this match? That's what this felt like. It was just like, and this match, I think it was announced like the night after King of the Ring. It was like 4 weeks
that they had been building this up for this DQ finish in 5.5 minutes, and it was largely done after this.
Yeah, not much of a match here. I suppose, I mean, you could have had Edge and Christian at least cheat to win if you wanted to, you know, get their heat and protect the Acolytes at the same time. But the following month, of course, they would do the TLC match, so they didn't even really rematch this. So.
Yeah, this is where you had the big three tag teams, and the APA was not threatening for a spot there. Then we had maybe... This is a future DVD, way. The best of WWF New York cut-ins. The Big Boss Man. Flown all the way from New York for this one segment.
To New York, yeah.
Yes. And asks one of the guys in the bar for his ID. And tells the guy not to step out of line. And then he chugs the guy's beer.
Yeah, Lawler called him the bouncer. He was demoted to being the bouncer at... WWE New York.
Hilarious. That was our contribution from the Big Boss Man here, Fully Loaded. Hunter is with Stephanie, and he is pissed that he has to worry about all this flower bullshit when he's got a violent match coming up later tonight with Chris Jericho. And Stephanie notes how the card never said it's from Kurt, but Hunter points out that it does say it's true, and Hunter's no dummy. And so Stephanie says, well, why don't you go confront him? And Hunter says, I will. And he leaves.
Did you like these kind of show-long backstage storylines to build up a thing on a pay-per-view itself when you're about to see the match?
Not this one in particular. I mean, they would do some of these stories on pay-per-views, much like Kurt and The Undertaker. You had all these segments before the match. And this show, it had a lot of segments, like, almost treating this like a Raw with the build-up to the big three matches.
I personally didn't really see the purpose, because, I mean, if you're already paying for the show, you didn't really need all this stuff. The storyline was all supposed to take place prior, so
yeah.
I would actually much prefer just them going the traditional route and talking about the match and, you know,
well,
cutting...
The Hunter and Stephanie, it did at least culminate in something with Chris Jericho, which was actually kind of baffling by the end of the night. But
right. As did Undertaker. And
yeah, Undertaker. I mean, it all had a point to it.
But again, what's the point of doing that on the pay-per-view?
On the pay-per-view, yeah. The Hunter, Stephanie, Kurt stuff was really good during this summer. It had a really bad payoff at the end because Kurt really got nothing out of it. But like these three were really good together, and this was a good storyline at the time. We go back. The Undertaker is still chasing Kurt Angle. What a match preparation for these two. And Taker is hobbling on this knee of his. And Angle, again, just runs around this perimeter and comes up from behind the Undertaker like this old man that's just lost and attacks him with the largest wrench you have ever seen. This was like, remember when Big Show had the giant size chair.
Yeah.
This was like a giant size wrench.
It was like a fire hydrant wrench.
This was like the wrench you would see in Jack and the Beanstalk or something. And he nails the Undertaker in the knee with the wrench, and it led to the Undertaker screaming in pain as he yelled, God, it's gonna be your ass, boy. The line of the pay-per-view from Undertaker.
It wasn't the moment of the pay-per-view from The Undertaker, though.
Yo ass, boy!
Yeah. Yeah, this was a very different Undertaker from the demon persona. I didn't hate the biker taker. I thought it was a very good, realistic update of the gimmick. But on this particular show, I thought he was made to look really foolish.
How about in both cases of Hunter and Undertaker, we had to do angles ahead of time to weaken them? As they still were going to win the matches.
I guess that was the idea, right?
Well.
To make you think that
different outcomes for both.
To make them want to get revenge. Yes, I understand. I didn't think it was necessary.
Nothing like a heel and Hunter going for revenge after he's been jumped. Some weird psychology on this show. Val Venus, accompanied by Trish Stratus, a lot of Trish Stratus on this show. This was when she was managing Val Venus, who came out to his remixed version of his original theme music. And this was bland Val Venus.
Yeah, this was like a Val Venus in transition between that porn star gimmick and the Right to Censor, when he chopped off his hair, lost all
the... Didn't know where you were going there.
the other thing was chopped off already.
Choppy, choppy your hair.
he lost the theme music. He no longer cut the Hello Ladies promo. He was just a guy in black trunks.
This is when they believed we can elevate this guy. Because they had a big movement at this point about trying to rise a number of these mid-carders up. And you forget that Bob Holly was one of those guys, and then he got his arm broken by Kurt Angle moonsault. They were in the spring of 2000 going into the summer. They had a lot of guys pegged to try and advance them, and Val Venus was one of them. But I think the rap on Val Venus is that he never could separate himself from that gimmick. And keeping the name that rhymes with penis was probably tough.
Yep.
There was a lot of things going against him. I mean, part of it was he played that creepy porn star so great.
Yeah.
That voice was so synonymous with a porn star.
They tried to rename him the Big Valboski. He just went by that.
That really didn't separate him much either. Yeah, and it was just he never could get out of that original character. And that's I mean, he was good. I never saw him as a main event guy, but at this point they were trying.
It's
they were trying
possible.
To.
I didn't see JBL capable of
yeah,
that.
Yeah, yeah. So, anyway. He was taking on Rikishi in a steel cage match for the Intercontinental title, and Val Venus won this title after Taz attacked Rikishi with a camera, and somehow Taz was facing Al Snow on this pay per view, and Rikishi was going after the IC title here. So. Ross brings up Trish whipping Lita with a belt like Lita was a dog, which I guess Jim Ross was kind of telegraphing a future Trish angle, comparing it to a dog. And Val got run into the cage repeatedly. Venus clipped the knee of Rikishi, and he goes for the door, but then runs Rikishi into the cage. Venus is Irish whipped and falls down in the corner, but stops the stink face with a low blow and then leaped off the turnbuckle and slapped Rikishi's head from behind in what was described as some type of bulldog maneuver. Both are climbing up. Rikishi's head is run into the cage. He falls down. There's an elbow drop off the top rope. Then they're fighting on the turnbuckle, and Rikishi gets crotched. Venus is cut around the left eye from the steel cage. Now, you want to hear something crazy. This was Jason Agnew's match of the year in 2000.
Okay, that is crazy.
That is kind of crazy. But it was like 10 minutes after I watched this match that Jason Agnew posts a photo where he has cut his left eye in the exact same spot where Val Venus had cut his left eye in this cage match.
Wow.
Don't tell me there isn't weird stuff at work. Okay. Crazy way. Rikishi hits a Samoan drop and then a reverse splash in the corner. He climbs up, hits a bonsai drop. Venus gets his foot on the bottom rope. And then, in a just sacrilege, Trish Stratus slams the cage door on the head of Rikishi in the very same arena where the most famous angle in world class took place on Christmas night 1982 with the Von Erichs and the Freebirds.
Why is it sacrilege?
Because this was not this did not even play into anything in the match. This wasn't even the finish. This was just a transition.
Yeah.
He's just, let's slam the door in his head.
That's a cute little reference if that was intentional. Probably not, but
I guarantee you there were people in the building that put it together. I mean, that is a famous angle in that city if you're a wrestling fan, even outside of Dallas. But it was not brought up by the announcers, and I don't think Jerry Lawler was going to reference it either. Rikishi then kicks out of the money shot. Lita comes down with the belt and attracts Trish with it. They did more build for this unannounced strap match on Raw the next night than most matches going into this show.
But the crowd really did like Trish and Lita. I thought they were actually a highlight of the show.
Yep. Also took off Trish's top and was just whipping her repeatedly as they went to the back. Venus gets bounced off the top rope and takes out referee Teddy Long. And then, with Venus laying on the mat, Rikishi climbs to the top of the cage, scales over to the middle, which even 16 years later, Way, I was watching with one eye closed.
Yeah, it's crazy.
I was just, could you have imagined if this guy tripped or just lost his balance? This is a near 400-pound man up there.
At the same time, though, I almost always forget that this is the same dude who used to be diving off the top ropes all the time as part of the Head Shrinkers. So he seemed to retain much of his mobility, even at his size.
But isn't it funny how no one remembers this spot?
I don't think I've ever seen this. I've never seen them replay this at all. You know, and this should be, this was the heaviest man I've ever seen jump off of top of the cage.
Him being thrown off the cell later that year into the truck. That's what I think people remember when they think of Rikishi coming off of a cage. But this was damn impressive.
Yeah, and he actually landed on Val.
Yeah, came down off with a splash onto Venus. I don't know what, I guess his money shot, much bigger. And there's a giant reaction for this. The crowd is chanting for Rikishi. We forget how over Rikishi was at this time in 2000.
Yeah, absolutely.
This was the peak of him.
Before The Rock.
Yes.
Before the car.
It all went downhill in the fall of 2000. But then Taz appears, and the door is open, and he smashes Rikishi, not with the cage door, but with another camera away. Taz has gone through more cameras than most television outlets.
More than the Fight Network, I can probably guarantee.
Two in a week.
Yeah, we could use those.
Large boos for this. And Venus rolls on top and pins him at 14 minutes and 11 seconds. So your winner is Val Venus. So after that giant splash, Rikishi doesn't even win the match. And he, I don't ever recall this feud involving Rikishi and Taz. I don't have any memory of it.
How many?
They didn't have a pay-per-view match out of it.
Yeah. I mean, you know, it was a really big match with some big, big spots, and I thought it actually turned out really well. Crowd, again, was very hot, especially for this.
So I like this match quite a lot. I thought both did a very good job here.
Mm-hmm.
Holy shit. The Undertaker again. We're in front of this workplace sign where it has the listing of how many days they have gone without any lost time due to an accident on the job. And it's listed as 49 days, and Taker wipes it clean. There's going to be an on-the-job incident on tonight's show.
See, I thought it was because he just got injured in the back by Kurt Angle. And I thought it was just like, again,
very responsible of him.
Really, like, cute of Taker to wipe out the record for his own injury, but it made Taker look really stupid.
Did you notice the other stat on this sign? The current record of days without an incident, 49 days. They had one more day to go and they would have broken the streak.
No, I believe it was 49 that he wiped.
So. Yeah, he did wipe 49, and then below it, there was another one that said date.
John, basically what happened was the current number was the record. Understood? So as you change the top number, you change the bottom number as well.
It says the best previous record was 49 days.
Okay, so
how do you not know that they didn't just tie the record? You're guessing.
It's more likely that both numbers increased at the same time because the new number was the new record every time it passed.
Well, then it would say the current record is 49 days.
You can't change what it says on the board.
It says the best previous record. Previous.
Yeah, so, okay, John, let's say it turns to 50. Let's say it turned to 50. You wouldn't change the bottom number as well to 50? You change both numbers. Once it passes the record, you change both at the same time.
No, you wouldn't.
Yes, you would.
You would. Okay, I'm saying if they reached 49 days without incident, and that's a new record. That goes at the bottom.
Okay.
And then there's an incident, and that one starts at zero, and that would stay at 49.
And he kept the bottom one at 49. He didn't erase the bottom one. He only erased the top one. Now the current record stands at 49. Had it continued, then he would have changed both numbers to 50.
Well, there's a lot of speculation here.
There's no speculation. This is clear and simple. Okay?
But wait, they had to tie it at some point.
Yeah, at some point, previously. Maybe they tied it at 30. Maybe they tied it at 32. Maybe they tied it at 47. Who knows? But it's not like they were one off of the record.
Okay, wait. So tomorrow,
I'm not giving this
starts
up.
A new day.
Yeah.
So it would be one.
Yeah.
And after that, it would be two.
Yeah.
And after that, three, and so on and so forth, until it reaches 48.
Yeah.
And then again, this still says 49.
Yeah.
And the following day, it would say 49, and you'd have 49 and 49 again.
Yeah. Okay.
Doesn't mean that that's a new record. It means we are approaching the record.
Okay. But he erased 49.
Yes, because 49's still the record.
I know.
Yeah, so what are you saying? You're saying that they tied 49 on that day?
Yes.
This particular day?
Yes.
I find that very unlikely.
Wait, I think the sign is bullshit to begin with. They just put 2 days.
No, we're talking as if this was real. We're talking as if this was a real thing. I find it unlikely that on the day that The Undertaker and Kurt Angle are here shooting a vignette in the back, they happen to tie on the same day.
Well, the WWF would never work numbers. You have your opinion, I have mine. There's no definitive way to end this argument. You have a theory, and I have a theory.
Your theory
is... No one's right and no one is wrong in this.
I'm right. Your theory is highly more probable to be incorrect than mine.
Well, I also feel that The Undertaker does not have the authority to be even touching this. Did you also notice that there's a microwave in use backstage at the Reunion Arena? No one worried about that, did they?
That I didn't see.
All right, well... There we go. The streak ended at Fully Loaded 2000. Taker erases it, and he's limping backstage. Then Hunter is searching for Kurt Angle, and he finds Harvey Whippleman with more flowers. I don't know how Kurt could have sent more flowers during this time while he's racing for his life, but I guess he maybe had time to call 55 Flower or whatever the quick delivery service is in Dallas. And Whippleman is asked, where is he? And Whippleman takes Hunter to his room. And Hunter goes into his room and closes the door when Whippleman says, oh, Kurt? You want Kurt's room? And then the door opens and Jericho has left Triple H laying on the floor, beaten, before this last man standing match. The match should be over.
Yes, Jericho had planned all this. Had planned to take Harvey Whippleman.
Do you think Jericho sent all the flowers as a swerve that this would lead to Hunter going to find him?
That's the insinuation.
I even pieced that one together.
Yeah, who would have sent the flowers?
Well, Kurt was legitimately flirting with Stephanie at the time.
But Whippleman led him. Was it Kurt Angle's room, though? It wasn't. Was it? Did it say Kurt Angle?
No, it didn't say Kurt Angle's room. It was just he said, where is he? And, I mean, this is a lot of faith on Chris Jericho's part to believe this plan would be executed so well, that Hunter would come looking for Kurt and Whippleman would stop him.
And at no point would he say, where's Kurt Angle? Instead would say, where is he? Where is he?
Oh, you meant Kurt? So there you have it. Hunter laid out before the match. Then we really got a Raw segment here. Shane McMahon comes out in his goofy gear of his Just Bring It shirt and his...
Dressing up like The Rock.
Yes.
Yeah.
He says to the crowd chanting at him that he is not a pussy, which was censored on this WWE Network show. So we're learning what the standards are of the network. Mm-hmm. That word is banned. So he wants to call out The Rock for a non-title match. Rock comes out and calls Shane a pussy, knows that this is a setup, and asks, where is Chris Benoit hiding? Is he under the ring? Is he going to come from the crowd? He wants to have their title match now. But instead, Chris Benoit appears on the Titantron from backstage in The Rock's locker room and says, The Rock isn't stupid enough to get disqualified now. And he's in his locker room, and he starts tearing apart The Rock's entire wardrobe. Why this man requires so much clothing for a pay-per-view in which he will not be wrestling in any of this attire, I don't know. But then, Chris Benoit poured gasoline on these clothes.
He didn't set it on fire.
No, he just left it with gas on it.
I mean, that would have endangered, I think, everybody if he had set...
There would definitely be an incident the backstage. The Reunion Arena would be set.
They'd reset.
It's already been reset.
Yeah.
And The Rock runs to the back, and God, Chris Benoit, I mean, he was a really awkward speaker.
He definitely got better, though. I'd say even in this, like, compared to how he was in WCW, I felt like he really had to try hard, especially to live up to the level of somebody like The Rock, which he would never be able to reach, but... I thought he was improved from where he even was in WCW shortly before.
What did you think of the pairing of Chris Benoit and Shane? Like, obviously the idea was having somebody there as a mouthpiece, but I would never classify Shane McMahon as a great speaker for somebody. This was a weird pairing, I thought.
a little weird, especially seeing the two of them walk out, because Shane is in fact taller than Chris Benoit. Didn't really help him.
Shane also looked like 18 here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but I thought Shane actually was effective. I thought he was in the match. He played his role well. Whether or not you know, obviously, if there was somebody like a Paul Heyman attached to Chris Benoit, I think that obviously would be better. But without somebody like that, I think Chris Benoit might have needed somebody.
He definitely did at this time,
you know, and maybe Shane was just the best option at the time.
There was a video package for Angle and The Undertaker. This all started with Kurt having a milk celebration backstage and getting the milk all over The Undertaker's motorcycle, which was identified as his Titan bike, and offered him a scooter as a peace offering. And it led up to Kurt finally having the realization that he's no longer scared of The Undertaker, and poured sewage onto The Undertaker's bike and then attacked his knee with a wrench. This was a classic WWF 2000 storyline where we just took our drop-down menu of angles. Raw sewage, promo, reversing your opinion as a heel. I mean, this just had everything way.
Something you could have programmed in a video game. Career mode.
Yes, and Kurt Angle look to take the next step forward in career mode against The Undertaker, fresh off his win of the King of the Ring the prior month. Taker races down on his bike and battles Kurt through the crowd, tosses him around ringside. The bell rings, and he lifts Angle on an early pinfall. He doesn't want to just pin him. He wants to humiliate this guy.
Not yet.
He keeps beating down on Kurt. This is all Undertaker. One-legged Undertaker, by the way. Killing Kurt, sends him to the floor, and finally, Kurt grabs his large wrench, because Kurt Angle, Olympic gold medalist alone, cannot handle one-legged Taker. He needs a wrench. Taker still maintained control back in the ring. His knee is clipped. Taker blocks a choke slam. Taker's choke slam is blocked, and then Kurt attacks the knee and just applies a submission hold. Taker gets out of that, hits him with strikes, hits a choke slam, then calls for the last ride. The crowd is hot. He hits the last ride, and he pins Kurt Angle in 7 minutes and 36 seconds. And, man, this was just – I don't think this program did any favors for Kurt.
I don't know if it did that much for Taker, to be honest. I thought he came out of it looking kind of silly in a lot of it. The Taker was supposed to be working with a knee injury, and I thought Kurt, you know, spent some time working on it, but I expected a lot more back and forth in this match. It just seemed like, you know, Kurt worked on the leg a bit, Taker came back, threw a couple punches, and then hit the last ride, and that was it. So it wasn't much of a match.
Think of the future matches these two had when Kurt was more just – when it was just a 50-50 match, and they had some incredible matches together after.
It was also before the time of Undertaker really, you know, becoming
more
known for his
early game. 2000s Taker to me was my least favorite. A lot of his matches were this, and we will be in store for a big feud with Kane coming up for SummerSlam, so that's going to heat things up. Also, Limp Bizkit lifted from this network version, and we had his 2002 biker theme. The Rock, during that entire match, finally made his way back to his locker room to discover his clothes all torn.
Actually, he was using Kid Rock at this time.
Oh, that's right. You're right. This was post?
American Badass.
Yeah, this was American Badass, and then later Limp Bizkit would be involved there too. Right. Then we got a video for the Last Man Standing match. This one didn't begin with a milk celebration. This one began with Chris Jericho forcing himself onto Stephanie with a kiss at the King of the Ring. And there were repeated warnings by Hunter. I want Jericho's ass. And Jericho...
He must have said that, like, they showed highlights of this feud, and Hunter must have used that line, I want Jericho's ass, like, 5 times. Like, he must have said it in every TV appearance. He really wanted his ass.
Well, maybe it was, I don't know. Jericho caused Hunter to receive a stink face and then cost Hunter a match against the Brooklyn Brawler. And Hunter then led a sledgehammer attack on Chris Jericho, bloodying him up prior to this last man standing match.
Jericho was really, really, I think catching a lot of steam as a babyface here.
Oh yeah, and you know, maybe the high point up until this last man standing was the Phantom title switch with Hunter and led to this program. So one thing was very certain, just in watching the video package for what we just saw with Taker and Angle and then this one, man, they burned through so many angles on TV, like big angles that were just not, like, granted, the company was on fire at this point. It's hard to really criticize this booking at the time, but you just watch this and it was just, you know, giant beatdown angles with weapon shots, and there was just so much going on at the time, and you were getting it on Raw and SmackDown, like big angles just out of everywhere. Hunter and Jericho, last man standing match. Hunter came out to his old theme song, which I thought was just a great theme.
This
was pre-Motorhead.
My time.
Yes.
Our time.
Did you like this theme song?
Yeah.
It was, I thought, very good for the time of 99, 2000. Stephanie comes out with him, and she is the women's champion at this point. Ross notes this is only the second last man standing match in the history of the company, with Rock and Mankind being the first from February of 99. Jericho's ribs are taped, and Jericho has the advantage early on. He attacks with a variety of strikes. Jericho then gets dropped on the barricade, injuring his ribs, and they did a great job. Unlike the Undertaker's injured knee, Jericho's ribs, I thought they did a great job of Hunter just working over his ribs and tailoring the entire match to that as well. Mm-hmm. Hunter, though, showing basically no signs of being knocked out cold 20 minutes earlier backstage, but whatever. Stephanie slaps...
How would you show that, though?
Well, what was the point of that?
I don't
attack.
Know. I have no idea. That show long thing. I get it was to put heat on the match, but yeah.
It was just forgotten when the match began. Hunter was 100% at the start of this. Yeah. And this was like 20 minutes after this attack. So Stephanie slaps Jericho while Hunter is in control. He's using an abdominal stretch. Jericho's selling the ribs really well. Jericho counters out. Hunter's all upset and shoves the referee, who shoves him back. A lion salt is attempted by Jericho, but Hunter gets his knees up, again targeting the ribs. There's a sleeper delivered to Jericho with his hooks in, and the pressure is on the ribs. Ross believes it's over from this sleeper hold, but Jericho gets up at the count of 9 and then does a crotch chop to Hunter, maybe offering something else instead of his ass. Hunter then hits a pedigree. Jericho gets up from that, and then Hunter gets a chair and attacks the ribs and the back of Jericho with the chair. Hunter shoves the referee, and then there's a low blow delivered from Jericho to stop the pedigree onto the chair, and now Jericho grabs the chair, nails Hunter, who attempts to get his hand up for the chair shot, and Hunter does a 2000 Triple H blade job.
Yeah.
The part where it's like he can't, he's trying to do a sit-up, and he can't, and the blood is just gushing out. No one bled like Hunter in 2000, I'll say that. He was a great bleeder in 2000. Jericho makes a comeback afterwards. There's a reverse Irish whip, and Jericho goes into the steps as they're fighting on the floor. Both grab monitors and hit each other simultaneously. I thought Stephanie, who I did not think was anywhere near the actress she would later become, I thought she really conveyed her just horrified looks very well. Like, she was just disgusted at the violence, and I thought added to this without overshadowing any of these any of the match.
Yeah, I thought her heel mannerisms were actually quite good. And it was it's a far different Stephanie than what we see or what we would later see. Her voice really high up, and she appeared to be much more innocent, but I thought embodied that princess, you know, character pretty well.
She was only, when you think about this, being on this major role in the WWE at the time, in the top angle, one of the top angles, she was only 23 at this time.
Wow.
Like, she's only 39 now. I mean, we forget just how young she was when she was thrust onto TV in early 99. Mm. Then they go back into the ring after both get up from the monitor shots, and Jericho applies the Walls of Jericho, and Stephanie runs in, and he lets go, and he puts Stephanie into the walls, which got a massive reaction, and Jericho gets nailed from behind by Hunter, which ended up being the same spot Hunter would tear his quad doing, breaking up the Walls of Jericho about a year later. Hunter gets a sledgehammer, misses Jericho, and hits the steel post. Then Hunter gets catapulted into the post. He attacks Hunter with the sledgehammer, and then Jericho sets him up on the table, on the floor, for a moonsault, but Hunter stops it with a low blow and hits a back suplex as they go through the U.S. announce desk, and Hunter is the one to stagger up at 9 to win the match, but then collapses in 23 minutes and 10 seconds. The referee, in admonishing this 10 count, took 40 seconds to do so. So that was our pacing of the count. When I watched this match in 2000, this was one of my favorite matches that year. I thought it was maybe the second best WWE match of the year behind Hunter and Foley from the Royal Rumble. And I thought this was Jericho's first great match since signing with the WWF. I loved this match. I remember as a teenager going back and rewatching this match. I enjoyed it so much when it happened. This is my highlight of the show.
I thought it was absolutely a great match. To me, Triple H in 2000 is Triple H in his in-ring prime.
It's a great year he had.
The guy had great pacing, great execution, was still light enough to be very mobile. And in this match, he worked so hard, took a lot of damage here, as you'd expect from a last man standing match. But I thought he led this match, and I thought he did a great job of it. I was very impressed with him here. Jericho, you know, obviously is Jericho. He's great too. He seemed like a baby face the crowd really connected with at the time, and the crowd really wanted to see him win.
Yeah, and I mean, you can look at the fact that all the main eventers won their matches, but to me, there was no comparison of look how much Hunter gave Jericho in this match and what he got out of it. Like, there's zero comparison to Kurt Angle, who got zero in his match. Nothing.
Ton.
I thought Rock and Hunter really did great jobs in helping their opponents even though they were losing. Mm-hmm. And people can be critical of Hunter, but I thought Jericho gained a ton from this match, and it was excellent. And it was also a great call by Jim Ross at the end of this. Putting over both Jericho and Benoit after their losses. I mean, Ross did a tremendous job of preserving them. Hunter is helped to the back. He's selling this like he is near death. Just a really, really great match. Then we got the main event video package with Benoit and Shane aligning. And Shane McMahon, with the voiceover, "We're just friends," as if to imply something other, I guess. We're just friends. And they joined in attacking The Rock. Rock giving him the match, not because you deserve it, but because it's personal. And Foley then made a ruling on TV that the title can change hands on a disqualification to ensure that The Rock tries to win this match and not just assault Chris Benoit in this match. And this also featured The Rock applying one of the worst crippler crossfaces you may ever see.
Submission game, not really.
No, the sharpshooter and crossface. Maybe it's those Canadian submission holds that just The Rock didn't always have the most finesse in applying.
His figure four didn't look that good in this match either.
Yeah, that's true. Yes. So that is our main event. The Rock and Chris Benoit for the WWF title. Chris Benoit's first pay-per-view main event in the company since coming in January. Shane comes from behind to distract Rock and leads to Benoit jumping Rock. And
whoops.
It's main event time. The Rock then chases after Benoit, and Benoit is catapulted into Shane on the apron, and this is when The Rock goes for the crossface, and Benoit flees to the floor. Benoit would hit a gutbuster and got control of the match. Rock kicks him in the chest, which Lawler describes as a XFL punt, and Rock then hits a back suplex off the turnbuckle. Benoit grabs the championship and hits a belt shot behind the referee's back, but only gets a two count. Benoit then applies the sharpshooter, and Rock struggles, makes it to the rope. Shane then pulls down the top rope, and Rock crashes to the floor. They fought on the floor. Rock runs his balls into the post, and the referee allows this, which Jim Ross points out, that could have been a disqualification there, nailing his balls into that post, but I guess not. Rock then applies the figure four leg lock in the ring, and Shane distracts the referee as Benoit gets to the rope. Shane clotheslines Rock on the floor, and then they fought into the audience. Benoit is working over Rock. Shane is just constantly interfering here, so we have the numbers game that The Rock has to overcome. Rock hits a – Benoit hits a diving headbutt off of the top, and then Rock comes back, spinebuster, people's elbow, and as he goes for the pinfall, Shane distracts Earl Hebner, and it leads to Benoit kicking out. Rock had great fire for his comeback. Then Benoit grabbed a chair. Rock took it away, and Shane hit Earl Hebner from behind with a chair, and Rock then attacks both. He chases off Shane, and right as Earl Hebner turns his head, he sees Rock dropping the chair onto the floor. It was like perfect timing. Yeah. It was just as he let go of it from his grip to the floor. And Rock applies a crossface to Benoit, and Hebner is staggering over. He calls for the bell. The announcers assume that Benoit has submitted. And instead, Finkel announces that The Rock was disqualified for use of the chair, and Chris Benoit is the new champion, and this crowd was furious. You really sensed what level the WWF title was at this time period, because they were stunned that The Rock has been robbed of this WWF title.
They were stunned we got trash thrown into the ring.
There was garbage thrown. Yes, which was not a regular occurrence in the WWF.
This is Dallas.
Yeah, Dallas, man. They were upset already, dumping on their hockey team, the assassination comment. Shane then attacks Rock with a chair, and Rock is bleeding. This is where they showed the replay that looked great, where you could tell Earl's point of view was he totally saw this chair being dropped. Then after a prolonged period of time where you're getting the celebration shot with Benoit and Shane, Mick Foley comes out and he gets on the microphone and says, "I didn't see a disqualification," and he orders the match to continue. The bell rings and Benoit hits him with three consecutive Germans. On the last one, he bridges and only gets a two count. Giant Rocky chant as Rock makes his comeback, but Benoit applies a crossface. Rock gets the rope break. Huge reaction as he grabs the rope. And man, this was just a babyface that this audience was just, they were in love with this man. Rock comes back with punches, hits his rock bottom, and pins him in 240 after the restart. And I thought the real MVP here was Jim Ross, who put this over as a war. He says these two will certainly meet again, and he would pay to see the rematch, and says we may have seen the beginning of a rivalry for the ages as we go off the air. Essentially saying The Rock got pushed to the absolute limit by this guy, and Chris Benoit is a player in this title scene. So I thought Jim Ross really handled Chris Benoit losing very effectively, and The Rock could not have felt like a bigger babyface on this show.
Yes, I thought it was a really, really good match, and I thought an example of a dusty finish used that I thought really helped the overall quality of the match and really took that crowd to the next level. The visual of seeing Benoit and The Rock wrestling with garbage still in the ring, I think, is a great visual. And overall, I really enjoyed the match, and I really enjoyed Shane's involvement here. I thought his role was to, you know, give Benoit the advantage and add heat, and I thought he was very effective at doing that. So overall, I thought it was a very successful last two main events, and I was also impressed by how hot this crowd was, especially following the last match, which was already very intense. Maybe it just goes to show you don't always need a buffer match when you have two really hot main events.
Yeah, it's a great point. I mean, that last hour of the pay-per-view was very solid between those two matches. So I think on the strength of those two alone, I give this show a 8.3 out of 10.
Why 0.3?
Really good commentary.
Okay, but not that great, obviously.
I didn't think this was a 10 out of 10 show because...
Why not an 8.5?
You know, 8.5, you got to be really, really delivering on... You know what? I'll go 8.4 because that cage match was a really solid part of the mid-card.
Why would you go 8.5, man?
8.4 is really...
You should just give it an 8 and round down.
I'll give it a 8.46.
Oh, jeez. You're making Brad's life hell right now.
Decimals, man. We've done a lot of these reviews.
I give it a solid 8.5.
Wow.
Yeah, so take that.
0.04 above me.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Well, this was a solid show, and as I've stated, that Last Man Standing match, that was one of my favorite WWF matches of that era. I thought it was just excellent, and I guess in terms of the goal of this pay-per-view way and putting these three in Benoit, Jericho, Angle in high-profile matches against established talent, it's hard to look at it at the time frame and not just see where they would eventually go. But, I mean, would you have left this show encouraged even though all three lost to the established talent?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I think I'd just be pretty thrilled at the quality of the wrestling coming out of this, and I'd be hopeful for the future for quality like this in other matches that we'd see on other shows. Jericho certainly seemed like somebody destined for a larger role. I think Benoit, in terms of in-ring, there's nobody that could touch him, of course, but I'd say he still probably needed a lot of work to be a complete, full, dominant heel package. So,
I guess my biggest negative on this show, I don't think there was any question, it was Kurt Angle. Here we are in the summer of 2000 as the Sydney Olympics are going to be starting shortly after this. It's the first Summer Olympics since he won gold. So you got an interesting story there. Here's this guy 4 years later. He's now a big star in the WWF. Mm-hmm. On top of that, the main event of SummerSlam was going to be The Rock, Hunter, and Kurt Angle. You watch this?
Yeah.
Makes no logical sense. Mm-hmm. The Undertaker would be having a feud with Kane. Benoit and Jericho would also have a match. That makes sense. Two guys coming off losses. That, to me, made sense. But Kurt was also headlining your next pay-per-view, which is a big show. And he was not even competitive with The Undertaker in that match. And I hated everything about that. Yeah. It was like, here was Taker. He was weak and no less. And still, it's like the only thing he sold for was the wrench. He sold for the wrench above Kurt Angle. I just thought it was very poor handling of Kurt. This program did no favors. I would have much rather seen Kurt just throw in a bone against somebody lower on the card and let Undertaker kill somebody else that's more expendable than Kurt, who had limitless potential at this point in 2000. So we'll now go to the Law message board, and Ronaldo writes in from Italy. I think this pay-per-view was a huge step for the WWE in giving new talent big spots. People may criticize Triple H because back in the day he was perceived as a roadblock for a lot of deserving guys, but his match with Jericho here, where he basically won just by standing up at the last second, was proof he was willing to elevate those he thought deserved the chance. The Rikishi-Valvinus match was pretty much a one-spot match, but what a spot it was, and still a sight to this day. Rock and Benoit was a great match and showed a lot of faith in Chris, even if the finish felt a little bit tainted. Great show.
Matt in suburban Detroit, I think that my biggest takeaway from this pay-per-view is that while WWE was doing an old guard versus new, that none of the new guard won. It wouldn't have hurt Triple H or Taker to take a loss to Jericho or Angle. Overall, a solid 2000 WWE pay-per-view, much better than WCW's Bash 2000, 7 out of 10.
We go to Christian. At this time, WWE seemed to love switching the WWE title and overriding that decision. They did this tease three times in 2000 with Jericho beating Hunter on that famous Raw in April, Benoit on this show, and at Unforgiven 2 months later. Not sure what they thought they'd achieve doing this, as neither would get the title until years later, and I think they really missed the ball on Jericho, who got a monstrous reaction when he won it. Speaking of Jericho, I love this match with Hunter. I think it made both guys look amazing, and Jericho was not hurt with the loss one bit. The loss also made sense, since they were planning on Hunter challenging for the title at SummerSlam, but what doesn't make sense was Angle losing to Taker, as Angle was the other third of that SummerSlam main event match. Overall, a very good pay-per-view in my eyes.
All right, we got a Chris from Oregon who says, I've listened to this podcast for a while, but decided this was a good event to make my first post. The summer of 2000 was when I first got into wrestling, which is pretty consistent with me being behind on the popular trends. So at this time, I only knew The Undertaker as a biker and Mick Foley as the WWF commissioner. Top to bottom, I thought this was a really good card with no matches that really dragged. The six-person opener was a fun, fast-paced match, and the steel cage match provided an all-time classic moment of Rikishi jumping off the top of the cage. As for the triple main event, all three for the Rising Stars did a good job in a more prominent spot, even if they didn't get the win. Maybe it's because this was the first pay-per-view I ever saw, but the Jericho Triple H Last Man Standing match remains one of my all-time favorite matches. I was also too new to wrestling to realize that the main event finish was a little convoluted. I'll give it an 8.5 out of 10, but completely admit this random pay-per-view has more significance to me than most others. Thanks for keeping the show going all these years. It's provided countless hours of entertainment, and without you guys, I would have never discovered the awesomeness that was Art Donovan at the 1994 King of the Ring.
A well-remembered man in wrestling history. David Duffenberg. Yahoo Sports posted an article a couple of years back rating the top B pay-per-view shows the WWE put on, and this was one of the shows on that list. I can't disagree with the article because this was really a good show. The crowd was into it the whole time too, which really helped out the show, even when the wrestling wasn't all that great. You can really tell it was when Trish first started to wrestle because she just seemed ridiculous in the ring. It's like she was in the bouncing fight pose whenever she was moving and wasn't natural at all. The Last Man Standing match was really good, and to me it's the one gimmick match the WWE seems to deliver the most on. I had forgotten the fact that they did the swerve ending where it made it seem like Benoit was leaving with the title, so that was actually a fun surprise. Rock and Benoit had some good chemistry together, and the match turned out really well. Overall, this gets 8.5 out of 10.
Jesse from the 6. Watching shows from this era, I'm struck by how much I would hate the American Badass character if I ever met him. He drives a big, loud motorcycle, he's rude with everybody, and he spits everywhere. What a dick. Also, I'm struck by how over Jericho was. Do you think if they had given Y2J a title run as a face at this time, his heel run as undisputed champ later would have been more successful?
I think there was certainly a time to go with Chris Jericho that you cannot deny they sat on for a while. And when they finally did put the title on him at the end of 2001, that was hardly slotting him as your top guy. I mean, he was still very much treated as almost this mid-card guy that stumbled onto the title. Hmm. I mean, that was, you know, they had all these guys, Benoit, Jericho, Angle. I felt for all of them, they were very hesitant to go full out with all of them. They really sat on them for a while and kind of flirted with the main event picture, and I think there was some lost time there. I mean, Jericho to me was someone you, by mid 2000.
Sorry, I was talking to this mic. What do you think is, was the contributing factor to that? Did anything have to do with their size, their lesser size compared to a guy like Triple H or Steve Austin or The Rock? You're in talking about Chris Benoit and Chris Jericho. You're kind of dealing with a different stature of wrestling.
I'm sure it had something to do with that. I mean, Jericho. I mean, he's one guy who it's literally an open book. I mean, he outlines this time where he had a lot of detractors and was told you don't know how to work. And he had to overcome a lot when he came in 99 and into 2000 as well. This was hardly a glorious period for him because he was being run down about a lot of his work and stuff like that. And I mean, the famous line was Vince saying, "You aren't worth the paper that your contract is written on." So, I mean, that really had to fuck with you mentally, I would say as well. This guy who was a pretty renowned worker by this point when he came in and then being told, "You don't know the first thing about what we do here." And I think there was a lot of that where you come in as an outsider and you have to acclimate to a very different style and win people over that maybe are not that familiar with. And I think Benoit and Jericho definitely battled that. And having to overcome that, which they did, it just took a long time. We go next to, you just read Jesse, right?
Yes.
Okay, let's go to The Flame, which features Grandpa Simpson on fire. What a image. It's neat to look back at a solid year 2000 performance by Y2J with the perspective that he may actually be doing his best work today, 16 years later. It's a shame that he was completely buried by Triple H and Stephanie during most of his prime. Do you think he owns another title before his current run is up?
Probably not.
I don't think he needs it.
No, he's beyond that, I feel. I mean, judging by his current run, he's really there to put over younger talent.
Well, and you always take comments Jericho makes with a grain of salt when it comes to when he's going to be around, for how long.
I think he'll retire anytime soon.
No, but he recently stated that this year Fozzy was taking the year off and then they're going to go full out in 2017. So if that is true, he's probably going to be gone for most of next year. Mm. And you would have to think if he's gone for the majority of next year, like, things are winding down for him. I mean, sure. He's what, 45 now?
Still in great shape, man.
He's in tremendous shape, and he's doing outstanding work. Mm-hmm. And he's a guy that doesn't need a title. He's somebody that works very effectively with younger talent. And I think a lot of that goes back to this towards the end of WCW and his first year or two in the WWF. The road he had to get to where he was, I think he has the complete opposite mentality when it comes to working with younger guys and being a bridge for them to get over instead of a roadblock.
Absolutely. I mean, just look at this past week when he did that segment with Enzo and Cass and Charlotte. I mean, three new people from NXT, essentially, and you have Chris Jericho, who's like a 20-year veteran. But Jericho doesn't seem out of place in that segment. He seemed like he fit in with those millennials. And also, like, him teaming up with Kevin Owens. He's taken a back seat to Kevin Owens in that team.
Yeah. I mean, even something as his podcast. How many guys has he helped get a personality across that you had no clue of before he just sat down and talked to the guy for an hour? Like Ryback.
Yeah.
That podcast to me was more effective than any of his years in the WWE.
Yeah, I want to continue with this feedback. But before I do that, John, I want to talk about I'm just trying to do one of his plugs. Don't you like on his podcast when he goes to commercial?
Oh.
But he'll fake like the middle of a conversation.
All right, we're going to talk about Ryback, but now it's time to talk about the True Car app.
True Car app. Oh, wow. I love it. And they're always so obvious.
What if we get to a point where we have to do those, and then that'll be very hypocritical?
I mean, I look forward to doing
them. You would do them the best.
Yeah. John, I want to keep talking about that coffee that you're drinking, but before we do that...
Have you done your yoga today?
Finally, Bret in Vancouver. Wow. Not a great pay-per-view undercard. Maybe it's just because I wasn't invested in the angles, but the mixed tag really didn't do anything for me. I couldn't have cared less about Taz versus Al Snow in WWF. I loved Eddie, and while the match with Saturn wasn't bad, Saturn really never got involved in much that I ever got interested in. I did, however, love the run E&C had at this point. Pretty decent cage match, I thought, and what a crazy bump from Rikishi. The triple main event, though, was where this show shined. Angle and Undertaker felt a bit silly in the pre-match video package, but the match was anything but. It was just good enough to be third from the top, but didn't overshadow anything else. Hunter versus Jericho was a solid brawl, though the counts were painfully slow, as pointed out by the King, and I didn't love the finish. I don't remember where this went, so maybe it made perfect sense, but either way, I thought the finish could have been better. Main event was nice outside of Shane's involvement. I really don't have much of a memory of this Shane-Benoit partnership, but it's always a pleasure to watch Benoit work, and The Rock was so over that they had pretty good heat all the way through. My question, as my memory is nowhere near Pollock level, where was Austin at this point?
This was when he was out with his neck injury. So he was he had had that surgery back in January, and he would be coming back in September.
And storyline-wise, he was hit by a car.
He had been hit by a car, yes. Turned out to be Rikishi, who was hired by Hunter. Hmm. So that was where Austin was at this time. But yeah, he was featured on the poster, but not back in time. So there you have it. That was our review of Fully Loaded 2000. And we've mentioned SummerSlam numerous times throughout this show. And that will be our next review. We will jump ahead to August of 2000. And our next review will be out Friday, August 19th, SummerSlam weekend. But you can start off by listening to a review of SummerSlam from 16 years ago. Headlined by The Rock, Hunter, and Angle for the WWF title, the first TLC match, and The Undertaker versus Kane.
Oh, yes.
Who's excited?
It's
going to be your ass, boy. All right, that's all for us.
What's happening on Friday next week? Is there Bauer and Pollock?
Yes, that's how the schedule will work, folks.
Cool.
Alternate weeks, review away, and Bauer and Pollock.
Nice.
So that is all for us. You can go to liveaudiowrestling.com or to lawradio.proboards.com.
Quick plug for our Review Raw TV portion. New contest we have. We're giving out a Pro Wrestling Tees t-shirt every single week. We are asking you guys, those very talented lot of you out there who have a gift to on the microphone, to show off your talents and cut a 30-second promo on your cell phone, in front of a webcam, whatever, and upload it to a video site of your choice and send it to us. Tweet at Law Radio with the hashtag PWTS promo, and you could win a Pro Wrestling Tees t-shirt and be featured on the video version of Review Raw that gets broadcast in more than one country on the Fight Network.
Yes, multiple countries. Mm-hmm. We'll get to see you. Garov was our very first winner.
Could be the second winner, too, if we have no other entrants. So.
Well, submit your entries, everyone. PWT's promo is the hashtag. Send it to us at Law Radio and tune in each Tuesday on Fight Network, and you can find out if you are the winner.
Mm-hmm.
So there you have it. And as well, Wade did a fantastic job on the video going through all of our entries for the Review of SmackDown theme song. Some great entries, which you can watch right now at youtube.com/liveaudiowrestling. A great job by Mr. Ting putting this video together during what was a very busy week for you. Still finding time for all the listeners.
And great job to you, John, on trying to deal with the move that we have virtually, digitally, on the website.
I don't know whose move has been more taxing. God,
yeah. Any updates on that?
Well, we have. It looks like our story archives are making its way onto the site, and I'm told the iTunes situation should be corrected. So,
okay,
all right. Stay tuned.
It's being worked on. It's being worked on in the Ukraine, I believe. So, it'll get fixed.
All right, that's it for us, folks, and we will chat with you later on this weekend.
Stop! Get downstairs.
Stop!
Just like on SmackDown.
Who's
angle that shot to the knee.
Go on, it's your ass.